Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine welcome Dr. Richard Edelson. Dr. Edelson is the chairman and Aaron B. and Marguerite Lerner Professor of Dermatology. He's also an internationally known expert in the treatment of cutaneous T-cell lymphomas using immunotherapy.
Tell us a little bit about what got you interested in focusing on this disease of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and on focusing on developing immunotherapies.
Thanks, Ed. From all the way back in my days as a medical student at Yale and then as a fellow at the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, and then as a faculty member at Columbia and at Yale, the common theme has been a fascination with the possibility of using the immune system to understand, diagnose, and treat cancer, and cutaneous T-cell lymphoma was an extremely good model for that, and a very important disease and dangerous disease in its own right.
So, Rick, I remember back from the National Cancer Institute days that many of us were actually focusing on attacking the tumor cells and thinking about ways to kill the tumor cells, but we forgot about the other part of the system, which is the normal immune cells and how, you know, they play a role in cancer. So can you just, for our listeners, explain a little bit about what the normal immune system does and how it impacts on cancer?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Francine, because that's a great lead-in to frame the entire story, and that is that the immune system is a wonderfully intricate, complicated, and well-organized, and I say organized much better than we even appreciate, a system that helps us fight infection, defend ourselves against all sorts of noxious or dangerous external agents and internal agents, including the distinctively bad cancer cells. And so the real challenge has been to try to understand how the many millions of different clones of T cells at the core of the immune system do their job. And they basically are as complicated as the neurons in the brain, but even more complicated because they float around looking for the enemy.
Now, I guess, you know, one concept that we were always kind of brought up with also was that cancer may in part arise from a dysfunction or defective immune surveillance system. So how do you kind of, you know, bring that concept within the concept of trying to harness the immune system to attack the tumor?
We now understand that while the three of us are sitting here talking and while the folks are listening, our immune systems are silently and very efficiently defending ourselves, all of us, against incipient cancers that are too small for us to ever diagnose. And one of the great examples is in the easily examined skin, where we've known now perhaps 60 years of experience-wise from immunosuppression following organ transplant, particularly kidney, that a high percentage, in fact, the majority of those patients who have had long-term immunosuppression to prevent the rejection of an organ transplanted from a different person develop enormous numbers of those skin cancers, such as basal and squamous cell carcinomas, that normally occur from sun exposure or overexposure. But these people, because their immune system was not able to rid them of those incipient cancers, can be loaded, and they are particularly dangerous in those individuals.
So, Rick, can you clarify for our listeners, we're talking about immune surveillance and the immune system, and there are different kinds of cells out there, the T cells and the B cells and kind of other so-called antigen-presenting cells. Can you just explain a little bit about how those different populations of cells interact?
Sure. There are three broad categories of cells at the center of the immune system, at least the center of an immune system intended to pick needles out of haystacks and destroy them if they're undesirable. They're the T cells, very broadly, and there are millions of different subclones or types of each one of these, but so we're just talking in generalities right now. The T cells are at the core of directing the immune system as so-called effector cells, or the cells that make things happen. The B cells are the ones that produce antibodies ultimately. The T cells can directly kill cancer cells if they are specifically targeted to a particular chemical in the cancer cells that distinguishes them. But the cells that are the ignition of the immune system, like the ignition in your car, are the dendritic antigen-presenting cells. An antigen is just a term that refers to those distinctive molecules that the immune system is geared to attack. So the antigen-presenting cells are the ones that take in, process, and present the distinctive chemicals, the targets that the immune system then becomes directed to attack. And that can be parts of proteins that are very distinctive, that separate cancer cells in general from normal counterparts. And in fact, in each patient, a cancer apparently may have, probably has, patient-specific tumor antigens or license plates.
So these dendritic cells are very important. Can you tell us where we find these in the body?
You find them actually acting in lymph nodes, which are the hubs where immune cells interact as part of the draining system called the lymphatic draining system in direct contact with the blood. And cells circulate or percolate through the tissues where most of the action needs to be. And that's where you really need the immune active cells if they're going to do their tasks of destroying cancer cells or defending against bacteria and the like. But they circulate through the blood to get to their site. In the case of antigen-presenting cells, largely as a population called monocytes. So we didn't mention them before. But approximately 20% of a normal person's white blood cells are in the form of monocytes. When they get into the tissues and get the right signals, they can become antigen-presenting cells, the ignitions of the immune system.
And Rick, are there ways, strategies in which one can activate or induce the numbers of these dendritic cells to fight off, in our case, to fight off the tumors?
And so Ed and Francine are leading me to the key question, and that is, how do you get an immune system which has actually been overrun by a cancer, or you wouldn't have identified the cancer? By the time we can recognize that a patient has a cancer, the cancerous cells have already accumulated to a point where they have evaded the initial immunoprotection or the sentinel anti-cancer T cells, B cells, macrophages, monocytes, antigen-presenting cells. And so the real question is, how do you take an antigen-presenting cell, such as the so-called key dendritic cell, which is normally circulating in the blood as less than 1 out of 1,000 of the white blood cells? That's not really as bad as it sounds, because you don't really need them in the blood. You need them to transit the blood the same way we don't really have the capacity to have conversations with people in the next car on the highway. So you need to get them to the site where you need them to do their job of kickstarting the immune system. And the question that Ed is asking is, how does that actually happen? How does a transformation of a trafficking monocyte into that ignition cell, the dendritic cell, actually happen? And that's been a very key question that goes to the core of perhaps why the immune system has as exciting an upset of opportunities as presented, in large measure, hasn't fully realized them. Because we have to learn how to do it the same way that the body does it. And what's happened so far, in large measure, is to try to find ways to artificially, in the laboratory, turn the monocytes into dendritic cells. And humans have not gotten nearly as good at this as the body itself. So the ways we have collectively approached that has been to take so-called chemical factors, factors that make cells mature into one type or another, and use literally industrial quantities of those, and we can clobber the monocytes and turn them into dendritic cells with levels of these factors that are really 1,000 times what have ever been found in the body. That's not exactly a good trick.
So, Rick, I understand that using those kinds of techniques, we haven't really been very successful. So generating those dendritic cells with these growth factors really hasn't been successful thus far. But you've actually pioneered a novel way of doing this, and you've provided tremendous insight into perhaps how the body is doing this. Could you talk a little bit about your development?
Sure. So one of the things that happens to us as clinicians / scientists is that we take a lot of clues from what happens in the actual patient. So I'll tell you how we've had some success, but it really came from careful observation. And I should mention that Dr. Francine Foss, to my right, has been central. So these are actually not questions that are pulled out of thin air for her.
Only under the tutelage of the master.
Well, that's very kind. but basically, in this malignancy of T cells, cutaneous T cell lymphoma, which we now recognize is approximately as common as Hodgkin's disease, not a terribly common disease, but much more common than we had previously recognized. And of course, it couldn't be identified until we could identify human T cells in the 70s, which is why it's still a relatively new name. That in our efforts to treat patients who had failed all conventional therapy, this devastating disease in its advanced stages, we found out that we had accidentally landed on a way to truly immunize them against their cancer, even after their cancer had expanded so much. And the key, in a nutshell, was this. By using a drug that's naturally existing in nature, actually found in small quantity in lime, figs, even celery root, does nothing by itself. It's called 8-MOP and well known in dermatologic circles because it can be activated by the kind of ultraviolet light that passes through window glass and normally doesn't even cause a sunburn to become a very pinpointed chemotherapeutic drug, only active where the light and the drug meet. We found out that if we injured malignant T cells in the patient's blood by passing it through a system, a very narrow field through between two plastic sheets that allowed the ultraviolet light to pass, a remarkable thing happens. If you returned only 2% of the patient's malignant cells damaged this way, they now often manifested a response, an immune response, that could go out and attack the other 98%.
So, Rick, this sounds really exciting, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the story. But we have to take a break now. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we are here with Dr. Richard Edelson discussing the use of the immune system to treat cancer.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. Rick Edelson, an expert in the treatment of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and immunotherapy. So, Rick, before the break, you were telling us about this discovery that you made to treat cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which was really the first immunotherapy that was used in cancer. And that's, I believe, is called photopheresis. So can you go on with your story and tell us how the development of this has led to the discoveries that we've recently made with respect to the dendritic cell?
The first clinical astonishing result occurred all the way back in 1982 and was reported by an international group that we led in the New England Journal of Medicine in the late 1980s. And as you pointed out, the treatment in 1988 became the first FDA-approved immunotherapy for any cancer. What happened was that we, of course, had tried to develop a chemotherapy that would have none of the classical side effects because it would only be active where the light and the drug came together. And classical side effects of chemotherapy, such as bone marrow suppression and even immunosuppression, hair loss, intestinal problems, wouldn't happen. But the big surprise was that when we returned those 2% of the treated cells to the patient in the first test run, thinking that we were just testing safety, the first two patients had a complete clearing of their disease. That only happens in a large majority, a minority of the patients, so perhaps 80% of those patients whose immune system's intact, which was a clue, that we were somehow marshaling the power of the immune system. The key then, and it's taken all of this time for science to catch up and give the tools that allow this to really be deciphered, fast forwarding to 2009, it's become quite an exciting story. First, this treatment has been used more than a million times worldwide, driven by the power of the clinical response and the safety of the treatment. It's been used now in that largest number of patients on both sides of the immunologic coin. So to turn the immune system on to treat the cancer, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, and in work that was pioneered by Dr. Foss, the same treatment, initially in a very puzzling way, has been used. In fact, this is now 2/3 of the use of the treatment worldwide as a major therapy to reverse an undesirable immune reaction. So actually to turn that off, called graft versus host disease, which is the major side effect following bone marrow transplant from a person other than oneself or an identical twin. So the question has been, what happened? And the bottom line is this, and after all of this time, is really only 2 years old and rapidly evolving. And that is that when the monocytes are passed through the same system outside the body where the light activates the drug which attacks the malignant T cells, or the T cells that can be causing a disease, the monocytes interact with the plastic surface in a way which we now recognize mimics the normal way that monocytes become dendritic cells in tissue, and we could not have discovered that except by accident.
Rick, is there any way to be able to identify which patients may or may not respond to your photopheresis treatment?
Yes. So the patients that respond and the patients that don't respond can be segregated largely on the basis of how intact their immune system is. So an immune system can be injured, of course, by chemotherapeutic agents that are being used to treat cancer patients or by the cancer itself. So the numbers are rather clear cut. If you take the patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma whose immune system is not intact, is quite not intact, there's almost no chance that this treatment, this immunotherapy photopheresis, will work. If you take the patients who represent about 25% of the patients with advanced disease, whose immune system is intact, 80% of them will. So clearly, the immune system has to be intact.
So it sounds to me, Rick, like we need to start thinking about immunotherapies prior to thinking about chemotherapy. Many of us as oncologists, you know, instinctively go to chemotherapy. But what we're learning from this certainly is that we need to look at the patient from an immunological point of view. And perhaps if there's immunotherapy to be administered, that should be thought about earlier rather than later.
Exactly. It's a different paradigm because there are certain therapies that are biologically based, particularly a marshaling of the strength and power of the immune system, which requires that they be early interventions. In fact, they are most effective at a time when the total number of cancer cells is small and the immune system has not been injured by prior therapy.
So what about the application of this to other kinds of cancers? This has been very successful with CTCL, but can you see ways that this kind of strategy might be useful in, say, solid tumors?
From the very beginning, it was clear that something extraordinary was happening biologically, and the biggest question was, could the mystery be deciphered? Could you figure out how this treatment was becoming such an effective immunotherapy in that cancer? And could you then apply, as you suggest, those principles, if you understood them, to other cancers, including solid tumors? The advantage in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma at the outset is that a malignant cell circulate in the blood where they're accessible to a treatment like this. And you can injure those cells and use them as their own kind of vaccine. But how do you do that with solid tumors? Now that we know that this treatment converts more than 50% of the blood monocytes into these igniting cells, these dendritic antigen-presenting cells, within a single day in a way that leaves the immune system intact and doesn't involve any major contortions requiring special laboratory activity, just the apparatus, the possibility exists that one can begin to use those cells to treat solid tumors. And the way that one can do that, at least in concept and we're beginning to test, is that those malignant cells in cancers such as lung cancer or prostate or breast or colon cancer can be obtained from the surgeon after the tissue is used that's been removed for diagnosis. You can take those cells and you can treat them so that they are now obtainable in single-cell suspension in saline or salt water, and then use them in combination, theoretically, at least it merits major testing, with these antigen-presenting cells to mimic perhaps what happens in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma.
And Rick, I understand there's been some very sophisticated work done in your lab in collaboration with other labs at Yale to try to take these tumor lysates and use these nanoparticles to help to introduce those antigens into the dendritic cells. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
One of the really primary reasons for having a cancer center is the way it brings together so many different experts from different disciplines under the broad umbrella of biology and cancer. And we have, together with my two partners here, we have eight different groups of these experts, and every one of those groups has contributed to this story. So, the science that was done involved finding out that 5,000 genes out of the slightly more than 25,000 in the human genome are involved in a very orchestrated way in this response.
And Rick, just to kind of get back to the use of photopheresis for other cancers, other solid tumors, there in fact is a clinical study at the Yale Cancer Center looking at this approach to treat lung cancer, as I understand.
Well, what we did is this is a treatment that was driven largely over literally 20 years empirically by its successes. And so clinical trials were leading the way and observations that were made from them as we all tried around Yale and around the world to figure out how this was working. And so a study was initiated, a clinical trial in lung cancer several years ago, but then the science began to truly answer, solve the puzzle and begin to really open a door. So at the current time, what we're doing is consolidating those scientific gains, completely revising those studies, because we can hopefully do them much, much better and smarter.
So we talk about photopheresis as being an available treatment, and you said that there have been a million treatments. How available is this for patients, and is this now available for solid tumor patients?
The first answer is easier, and the answer is that it's present throughout the United States and Europe in virtually all geographic areas, at least represented by one major tertiary care center in that region. And in Connecticut, the single place that it's done with a lot of expertise is here right at Yale. But one can find it virtually any place in Europe and the United States. In terms of the question about solid tumors, it's not yet available for that purpose.
And Rick, you've also done some research, I understand, in terms of looking at ways of making this whole process better. And this term transimmunization has been used to describe that process. Can you just briefly describe that for us?
It's always a little embarrassing once a puzzle begins to come together of any type to admit that it took so long to see it, because this will sound very simple. It turns out that if the components, as they appear to be, of this treatment success are really simply, number one, slightly damaging the cancer cells so that the immune system cells can recognize them as damaged and allow them to be used, turning on the monocytes to become dendritic cells and then bringing them together so that together they can form a cellular vaccine. And if it takes one day for the damaged cells to really show their damage and one day for the monocytes to become dendritic cells, it was a simple key. Why not just hold them together for one day in a controlled environment to make it easier for them to come together rather than squirting them back into the body and making them find each other? And that's what transimmunization is. It's a simple but major step forward.
Rick, you've been really the pioneer in this whole field of immunotherapy for the past 25, 30 years. Where do you see the field developing, evolving over the next, say, 10 to 15 years? And unfortunately, we have a very short period of time, so maybe a quick answer.
I think the real quick answer is that right now, the level of knowledge about the fundamental ways that the immune system works has gotten to such a level that we can do this and a number of other therapies and evolve more therapies more rapidly than ever before. But it's really a story that's coming together very nicely. So I would not hold the past promises that have been unrealized against immunotherapy for cancer, but the future is now.
Well, Rick, we certainly appreciate you joining us on the show this evening, and we look forward to having you come back and tell us how the story evolves.
Thank you, Eddie and Francine.
You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our special guest expert, Dr. Rick Edelson, for joining us this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.